Welcome to the Walking Through Time podcasts. There are plenty more to make your visit to New Norfolk more enjoyable.
Well, it was originally set up as the country house for the governor and his family. And when you think about it, it was ideally situated because it was in a high part of the district. There was rivers on two sides, and it was therefore easier for the military to guard them. And when they were in residence here, there was probably a section or something or other was sent to guard them. And so they came up here because in those days, Government House in Hobart was situated at the end of Elizabeth Street between Franklin Square and the Town Hall. And of course you can imagine there were thousands of prisoners there, but there were no jail to hold them, so they were roaming freely around. And the governor's family, of course, had were prisoners in the government house there. So they used to come up, they were rowed up by the prisoners, started off early in the morning, rowed up here and took up residence up here for a holiday. Fast forward then to when Franklin was the governor. Lady Franklin, of course, was a great one for education and so forth. You realise, she was a woman who was well off in her own right, had her own money, and she decided that using the example of England, where the places of higher education like Eton and Cambridge and Oxford were away from the capital city, she thought that New Norfolk would be the ideal place to set up a university, or a university college anyway. So apparently she got the okay, and I think she would have gone ahead whether she had the okay or not anyway. So she engaged headmaster to come out here. He was the head, I think, of Rugby College in England at the time. And they decided to go ahead and build this university college here. So the foundations and everything were laid, and the governor, with due pomp and ceremony, was to lay the foundation stone. It was all beautifully prepared and everything. And as was the custom in those days, they put a coin underneath the foundation stone, and they put a gold sovereign underneath this foundation stone. All the ceremony went off in great pomp and so forth, and then during the night some of the boys decided they went along, and the cement of course hadn't set properly, so they just pushed the foundation stone over and stole the gold coin, one guinea coin. They rolled the foundation stone into the river, apparently. I know as kids we used to go down there diving, and we were always going to look for this stone. Anyway, so that was the end of it. And you think then, only for that act of vandalism, New Norfolk could have been a university town from that day onwards. And I understand eventually that money was put in trust that Lady Franklin left, and eventually built the first university college on the Domain, or it was partly used for that. And then, of course, it was sold eventually when the new government house was built, or just about ready to be built. And it was sold, and the Shoebridge family bought it. And they had been trying to grow hops, so they'd grown them up in North Hobart, but then it became too big in the area there. They tried Maria Island, and they tried Richmond, and then Turriff Lodge came on the scene. So they took a lease of that and came to Norfolk in 1848 and grew the first hops. And that was the beginning of the hop industry in New Norfolk. Yeah, they ran along the flats at Turriff Lodge. And then, of course, they expanded over to Valleyfield and then up to Bushy Park. Then, of course, eventually that was sold. And then I think the McKinnon family came from Scotland. They came from a place called Turriff, up there, a town called Turriff. So it was called Turriff Lodge. And then it went on to eventually to the Onslow family. And then later on, the council decided to put in the sewerage scheme along there. And so they put it in there. And the Onslow family apparently took a order out against them for, damage or compensation or something like that. It was going to be a recurring thing. So it was acquired by the government and then assimilated as part of the Royal Derwent or Lackner Park home farm at that time. So
It was just lovely. It was a very big house, big, you know, all over the place, big spread out house. And there was some very large rooms, and which apparently when the governor decided he would like a summer place to come up to, they built the big rooms onto the cottage. So there was always a mixture of rooms, and they always came up by river because the roads were practically non-existent then. So yes, apparently the governors used it for some years, for about 10 years, and then apparently about 1900, their then owner built a new front to the house, a great big drawing room, a big entrance hall, and a full-sized billiard room, and they all had these French big windows, and it was beautiful for entertaining. So that's what I sort of grew up in. I can remember Dad used to have friends to play billiards on Saturday nights, and I can remember getting under the billiard table out of sight, hoping they wouldn't think of me. But, things there, it was just lovely, really. Well, this was it. It was originally in the 1880, it was a government farm. It was just a farm, and it belonged to the government, and they just had an overseer or someone living there. I'm not sure which governor it was. It was in 80-something. Went up to visit, and they came up by river, and, of course, then they could get up to the house from the river. And he was so taken with the view, you could see way up the valley, it was beautiful views, that he decided that they'd put two or three big rooms on for their use. And they used to come up and use it as a summer residence, come up for a weekend sort of thing. And they apparently mainly came up by boat. But the convicts, of course, had to walk up. And that's how the jug came into being. After that was built, because they'd walk from Hobart, and then they'd be put there overnight. They put in that as a little jail overnight. Oh, and the house, it had a high wall right around the yards. So you had everything inside the yards, your laundry, your coal sheds, your wood sheds, everything. It was hops and apples when Dad bought it. And then gradually things went during the war, the fruit wasn't worth buying, and then there's so much work, all the pruning to have to done, so they pulled that out, and he started the dairy, so that when the war came along, the dairy there's no refrigeration then, and so they had two milk runs, both leaving at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they'd be back by 10, so that people got their milk before the day there was any heat in the day. So during the war, we lost a couple of men, and we gained a land girl. So the land girl and I did. I filled in every if the milkman, if he was also the ploughman, if he had to plough, I'd do the milking. If the men on the other round delivering had time off, I'd do his round. And if the land girl, she used to save her time up. She had a day and a half a week. She took her Sunday afternoons, but she saved up her Saturdays. And then when she had 7 or 8, she'd go home for that 7 or 8 days, and I'd do her round. So I was there, but I was filling in wherever needed. A land girl is somebody during the war that joined a land girl and worked on the land. So they did all sorts of things, in England particularly, land girls practically ran the farms. But no, it was, I found, because I loved animals and I had a lovely horse, and I was quite happy on the farm. I didn't want to be anywhere else. My brother came, he was let out of the army almost as soon as war ended, because Dad was dying and they needed him at home. So he came home, and then I sort of got married and not being able to get a house. I came to an agreement with the milkman who took the house over, and he was quite happy that he had the northern wing and I had the southern wing. And so I think I was there for about 6 years, 7 years. So I paid him rent for it, and, you know, that worked out well. It meant we had a roof over our heads. That was good. The house was left empty because the manager who was managing the farm at the time, that was a government bloke, we were all out of it by then, his wife didn't like the house. It was too big and too spooky, she said. So it was left empty. And after 10 years of emptiness, it was a wreck. It was just pulled to pieces. So then they just finished pulling it down, and that was it. Well, they acquired it because the council put the sewerage on the farm and spoiled the hops. And Jones & Co. rather pushed Dad into do something about it. Well, he couldn't do anything. And when they put the sewerage in, as I say, he couldn't stop it. So, but he did try to stop it. And then that's when the council went to the government and they said, come on, they're being difficult. So the government just acquired it. So that was it. The council went ahead and they did all the damage. Like they pulled the jug down they bulldozed it down when they wanted to put another sewage line through.
Tell me about when Bill Lancaster and that whole episode.
It was 1929, approximately, and I was going to a little school at the time. I was about eight, and anyhow, they were to land in New Norfolk just for about half an hour, and then fly on to the northwest coast, but when they got to New Norfolk, of course, the whole town practically, the inhabitants of the whole town were up there, especially children. And every time they came down to land, everybody rushed over, you see, so that they didn't plough through them, they had to go up again. And at one stage they were close to a hedge, and rather than run into the crowd, they ran into the hedge. They got up again, but it meant that they couldn't fly out again. And when they finally landed, that lighted a fire for them to show them where to land, and I think they landed on it in the end in desperation. Of course, in the photo, there's a photo when they had taken their headgear off and they were standing with the crowd, and my father was right in the forefront of that. I don't know quite how it happened, but somehow they found something for them to do in the afternoon, and then they had dinner at Turriff Lodge that night. Mother cooked a dinner for them. And, of course, there'd be the big wigs as well. There were 12, and she cooked dinner for them. And I don't know whether they stayed the night at Turriff or not. That's something I remember Mother cooking. I remember the table being all set up, looking beautiful. And then I was sent to bed. So I don't know what happened after that. I think that's why they sent the photo there afterwards, just to sort of thank you for the dinner from me.
And there's a story about your dog taking you for a walk.
Oh, yes. His Nibs, he was called. And I was that size and he was that size. And I used to just hold him by his collar. And he'd toddle off and I'd toddle. I'd be with him. I don't remember that, but the family told me. But it was all right until he took me out on the road one day. And one of Mother's friends saw us and rang Mother. And, of course, just panic, panic, panic. But no, he looked after me very well. No, I just loved it. I loved Turriff, I loved the family, I was just so happy. I had a wonderful childhood. And then I had 6 years of boarding school at Collegiate in Hobart. Had a lovely season coming out, you know, debutante and all that sort of thing. It was the last season because the war broke out and that was the end of it.
The Walking Through Time Project has been made possible through the assistance of the Australian Government's Your Community Heritage Program and funding from the Derwent Valley Council. We would like to thank the many members of the public who have given freely of their thoughts and memories to make this project a success.